I think otherwise, when it comes to finances, look, I tell people it's going to be a very challenging time. By the late 2020s, the entire economically relevant world, by that I mean the entire high-income world plus all the emerging markets, will actually be experiencing a decline in their working-age populations in the aggregate. That's extraordinary. That's the first time that's happened since Adam Smith first wrote about, you know, the wealth of nations and the first glimmerings of the Industrial Revolution. This is something that we're not used to dealing with. And I think that's the backdrop in something that's pretty a generational crop. You know, in other words, a generational rhythm is going to be bad anyway. You know what I mean? On top of that. And so I think it's going to be a challenging time. Volatility has been it will be extraordinary.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with New York Times bestselling author and demographer Neil Howe. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Neil, in which he explains why we are now deep within a fourth turning when the status quo disruptively falls apart, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Neil Howe. I'm curious as to where the new leaders are going to come from. And the spirit of this question is, in a lot of the great turmoils of the past, whether they happened in a fourth turning or not, you had a lot of great voices that came out and they had a platform and they built a following around, and then it drove changes. And you know, I'm even thinking as recently as the late 60s with the civil rights movement and the women's movement and whatnot, equal rights movements, we'll call it. You had a lot of great leaders and new voices come out of that, but I kind of look around right now, I don't see very many. And I don't know if I'm just missing them or if this isn't the part yet in the turning where they emerge, or if we just have a bad batch this time around.
So, you know, Henry Kissinger, who I believe just had his 100th birthday. I mean, he's right about there, right? And he's a member of the GI generation, you know, and recalls Germany and the war and, you know, everything, right? He was once asked this question about what worries him most. And he gave an interesting answer, which I think echoes a little bit what the spirit of your question. And he said, "What worries me most is the quality of leadership today." It's kind of an interesting, I mean, he could have said anything. He could, "What worries me most is China," or you know what I mean? He said, just the quality of leadership. And I think here's what something to think about. During the third turning, remember, government was gonna disappear. I mean, what exer cared about a government job? Who wanted anything to lead politics? Politics was a vestigial atavism. It was gonna just die away. It wasn't necessary anymore, right? You wanted to start a new dot-com company, or you know what I mean? You wanted to be an entrepreneur. All the talent went into making money. No talent goes into politics, especially in America during a third turning. What, during the 1920s, what talent went into politics? No, everyone was trying to, I don't know, found the next new radio station or the next new, you know, a phonograph company, or you know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about. The emphasis was all on entrepreneurship, sort of individual initiative. No one cared about politics. And I think we are in the hangover from a very long third turning, right? So the whole rising generation of X, and even a lot of millennials when they first came of age, just thought politics was irrelevant. And now we're beginning to wake up. Right. I think very recently with the recent elections, we're beginning to think there's an enormous void up there and nature abhors a vacuum. Right. So a lot of stuff is going to rush in. My lesson in history is that this has happened again and again in fourth turnings. And typically great leaders in fourth turnings are not born, but they're made. These are people that no one expects. I mean, who would have expected Abraham Lincoln? He had only been to Congress once, you know, 2 years as a congressman, not terribly popular. He voted against the Mexican-American War and everybody hated him. And then he disappeared. That was it, you know. Well, where did he come from? Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a lightweight. I mean, no one thought he was a profound mind. He in terms of his knowledge of economics, he was a Lilliputian compared to Herbert Hoover, who truly was an encyclopedic mind, an impressive man. Unfortunately, he knew so much about economics, he was all invested into the wrong lessons. So my lesson is, expect a leader to come out of nowhere. Expect a leader that we, even at this late date, may not know. And the other thing is that this is a positive feedback system, meaning what happens is that when you approach the crisis and you get greater, closer and closer to the climax, because leadership is generally bad, every time you elect a bad leader, it just makes the climax worse. Mm-hmm. And it makes people more desperate for someone who can do something, right? I mean, you think of why in the world did we elect James Buchanan, you know, in 1856? I mean, this guy, he had nothing to offer except that he was, you know, by now he was the Democrat from Philadelphia or Baltimore, I can't remember, but he was sort of in line, you know, for the next post as presidency. And he had an atrocious presidency. He did nothing to solve any of the gathering storm in America that was leading us to civil war, right? And so the worst leaders we elect just furthers the crisis itself, and eventually calls forth completely new kinds of people that we eventually get. I think it's likely it will be a boomer, obviously an Xer, just given their ages. I do talk in my book, and I Bill and I introduced this back in the fourth turning about the gray champion, you know, the stern and yielding figure who actually presides over the crisis. It's an interesting idea. That role could be filled by a boomer or by an Xer. We've had both instances in American history. But leadership, leaders are born, not made. We've had plenty of incredibly ambitious and able people who just didn't hold the presidency, you know, during a time of crisis and really weren't able to do much with the presidency. I think of, you know, compare Franklin Delano Roosevelt with Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt was a prodigy. I mean, that guy could read 3 books a day. He wrote many books. Many of them are actually brilliantly written. I mean, the guy was a towering intellect as well as just a force of nature, personally.
Just a forceful mind, and manifested.
And when you think about it, if he had been president during the New Deal, I mean, you know, what would that have been like, right? But again, it's not how you're born. I mean, I think Theodore Roosevelt had that from birth. I mean, he was an incredible personality, obviously. It's the times. The times makes the leader. And it can make a leader out of even the most modest and unauspicious person who just finally figures out something has to be done. And I'm going to be that person, steps up to the plate.
All right. Well, that makes me feel a little bit better, where sort of like they say, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher will emerge, kind of when he's most needed, the next generation hero will emerge. Yeah. All right. Well, look, one thing I meant to mention earlier, but it's a nice segue to my last main point here, which is hearing you talk about kind of how we just sort of have to go through this stuff to get to the better part. It sounds very much aligned with Stoicism, right? Where the obstacle is the way, right? Where, you know, the only way we fix these big societal issues that are the reasons the whole fourth turning is really kind of stumbling under is we just finally have to grab a hold of these, you know, third rails and say, okay, look, how are we just going to fix this stuff, right? We got to do what it's going to take. We need to do what it's going to take to get beyond this, right? So as the right leaders emerge and we start to do this, what do you think is going to characterize the new dawn from here? Like, where is the hope in the story? Okay, we make it all through the hard years that we have ahead between now and hopefully no later than early 2030s-ish. What can we be looking forward to coming out of that?
A world which is more, in which there's a greater sense of equality, and a greater sense of opportunity across American society, where a large share of America will have participated will have played important roles as civic participants in the mobilization for the crisis. And they will truly, genuinely feel that they have a share in America's future. And that will be a positive feeling. They will expect more from government. The government will also expect more from them. So we'll have a much more sense of engagement between the national community and the citizen, as we had coming out of World War II. And that gave us that great sense of national optimism, which lasted for decades. Of course, you know, boomers hated it, tried to do everything they could to stop it. But it really did underpin the prosperity and the success, and some would say eventually the complacency, even the blind overreach of America, you know, decades later. But that will come out of it. You know, I'm reminded when you talk about leadership, grabbing the third rail and all this, I'm thinking about Winston Churchill, you know, after his days of darkness. And of course, Germany and invaded Belgium, invaded the lowlands, eventually invaded, Norway, and eventually Chamberlain had to resign, and Churchill became prime minister. And his first speech was, "The only thing I can promise you is blood, sweat, and tears." You remember this basically, but he also said, we have to go through this, you know, just for our survival, much less sort of the survival of the flourishing of freedom after this is over. But he also talked about what he called the sunlit uplands, you know, when this is over, right? There will be, the future will thank us today for what we do. It was a wonderful vision, right? He had both the vision of the near-term austerity and the near-term sense that, no, it's going to be horrible for a while. I'm not promising you anything for the near term. You know, unlike, Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain and all these conservatives before him, they always wanted to deny that there was any problem happening with Germany, right? He said the opposite. He said, no, we're going to go through this period of terrible sacrifice, but eventually, right, we have this better world that we're going to reach. I think that's kind of the vision that I think he was a far-sighted leader. And I think he saw that. I think where we're going to go is, when we're talking about the positives, the sense of social equality as well as economic equality, the sense that institutions are really in charge, which they aren't today. You know, institutions pretend to be in charge, but no one pretends to be able to do anything today, right? I point out that, today, you know, we go into Iraq, you know, we're there for a few weeks, and, you know, everyone thinks we're not going to stay there for very long. And of course, we weren't. And we say, well, no one can engage in nation building. Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm old enough to remember, but certainly my parents lived through it. But after World War II, we engaged in some pretty heavy duty nation building, as I recall. Let's see, yep. Germany, Japan, South Korea. I mean, can I go down the list of building nations, which actually succeeded pretty well? But we were committed back then, right? We had authority that we don't have today. And we had perseverance and we had sticking power that we don't have today. But the sense of diminished capability will be resolved as well. So America will be, again, more than the sum of its parts. We will be more modest in our individualism in this new era, right? We will be more modest about, you know, talking about me, myself, and I all the time, which is what we tend to do, you know, today and recently. I often say that if you go into a bookstore the last few decades, you know, all the most positive books are about me, myself, and I. You know, I can do anything. I can triumph mm-hmm. over the world. And all the worst, most downbeat books are about what we share in common. It's like the death of politics, the death of the family. You think about it, right? But that's the fall season, right? That's the fall season, right? But in the first turning, in the spring season, it's the opposite. We're more modest about ourselves individually, but we brag to each other about how well we work as a community. I mean, think about that. That's a more appealing image, isn't it, today, than it was maybe back in the 1990s? I think that appeals to a lot of people, and I think particularly it appeals to millennials. And let me say, this is my most important point. The biggest thing we do in this next first turning is to tip the whole playing field away from the old toward the young. It's their turn to rebuild a huge, better future for themselves, for their future selves, for their families, and not just have a system that rewards the old for what they've done, which I think increasingly what our system in America does. We don't care about piling up unlimited liabilities, both, you know, whether or not they're on the books or unfunded on our children. We give them free college and we just borrow, you know, we put it on their backs, right? So we're going to give them free college, we borrow it, and then we give the billions of dollars to these endowed universities that already have billions. I mean, the things we do are just mind-boggling, right? And what do we care? We don't really care about their future today. All we care is about making sure that anyone who has benefits today, and this is mostly those of us who are older, are guaranteed to continue them. That's the bottom line. And I don't care about all this budget balancing stuff. No one wants to touch any of that, right? That's genuinely untouchable. In the heat of the crisis, Adam, all of that becomes touchable. Because once it's our actual nation's future at stake, and once people begin to realize the trade-offs, all that stuff will suddenly be on the table again.
And that's so interesting. So I talk about that a lot on this program, Neil, both economically, where, I was just talking about this, forget who it was with, but they talked about how Schumpeter warned against this, where he said that capitalism might become too successful, where those that succeed begin to reinvest that success back into the system to write the rules even more to their advantage. And you kind of end up with these corporate cartels that run everything, including the government, right? So that's happening. I mean, I think we can admit that has largely happened on the economic side of things. And then when you look at it on a household standpoint, we see how the wealth is concentrating more and more and more in the top 1% or the top 0.1%, right? And that's what's causing a lot of the younger generations to kind of just give up hope here, because they're like, the American dream, catching that brass ring, there's no way I'm going to be able to get there given, you know, where I'm starting from and the advantage that these guys already have, right? But it's, to your point, it's not touchable right now politically. And I think it's a really interesting and maybe like really prophetic point we need to look at, which is, it's the fourth turning that may actually be the mechanism by which that correction happens. It may not be pleasant. It may not be good for any, you know, it may not feel good to anybody as we go through it, but it may be what's necessary to get to that point where we have some sort of equalization or equilibration where, you know, much greater swaths, especially of the younger generations, begin to claw their opportunity back, right? You're nodding as I'm saying all this.
Exactly. And I think the great golden ages of history always follow great crises, right? Think about that. When you think about the next first turning, I mean, in fact, the first golden age really to be commonly referred to as a golden age, the age of Augustus, you know, when he proclaimed this to be a golden age, and all of his, you know, all the pundits and poets around him, you know, from Virgil and Ovid and Livy, and, you know, they were all saying, yeah, the new, you know, saeculum aureum, the new golden age has emerged. Well, it was after a period of horrible civil wars, right, which eventually eviscerated and destroyed the Republic. Well, he invented something called the principate, you know, the sort of principate. It was a kind of an empire, but it was, everyone regarded it as a golden age. It was a piece of, it was a time of abundance and prosperity and peace, which lasted for, you know, a good 100 years until the next round of civil wars, and then it went on. But my point is that these periods of crisis, when we reshuffle the system and remake the system, are kind of the gate of history, and that's when we pay the price for this new period of optimism and growth. We rejuvenate ourselves civically. In terms of our civic institutions, and that's the purpose they serve, to serve the new set of generations, right? Which is coming of age and growing up in this new system. That actually is an interesting burden to what I call the artist archetype, who are the children of the crisis, right? Because they actually miss going through the crisis themselves, but they have all these expectations of being those for whom the crisis was fought. It's kind of the Saving Private Ryan syndrome, you know? What, he did that for me? Am I worthy of that sacrifice?
Right. Earn it, buddy. Yeah, exactly.
And I actually talk about that in the book, you know, sort of the burden of this that rests on the silent generation, their lives for feeling this burden, right? They were the ones for whom all this was done. And they were the ones who didn't call much attention to themselves, right? During the 1950s, and they sort of merged seamlessly into the middle class. They wore all those gray flannel suits, right? They were the Jack Lemons, you remember, in the apartment. They just sort of, you know, they didn't raise their heads. We had universal conscription back in the 1950s. Did you ever hear of a youth riot over it? No. They all obeyed. They all went right into the military. That even Elvis Presley, you know, shaved his hair, went right in. But it's interesting that history is always a blessing and a burden in a different way to each generation. There's an interesting balance. It's a balance in a different way for each generation. And I think that's what makes history so interesting to me when looked at from the perspective of the generational diagonal, right? What's fascinating about life is that we grow a year older every year time passes. And the reason why I call this a generational diagonal, it's actually not a phrase of my origin, but if you look at time on an XY axis, you think of years on the Y axis and age years on the X axis and age on the Y axis, we all live a diagonal line. Mm-hmm. A generation is a series of diagonal lines. And an event is a vertical line through all those diagonals. And everyone experiences that event differently depending on their own diagonal and what they experience, right? And when you look at life that way, and you look at political behavior that way, and you look at how generations are shaped young in a certain way, and they're formed in their behaviors and attitudes, and later on, 40 years later, they then shape history in turn, right? And then shape the new younger people coming along with them, that there is a system there. There is almost an economy. And it's fascinating to look at. And I do think it's the royal road, so to speak, to looking long-term at our future. I'm a demographer. I do look at, you know, mortality, fertility, morbidity, migration, all that stuff. And that is a great way to look at the future. But I think looking at the aging of generational behaviors and attitudes is yet a better way. And that's kind of the heart and soul of my method.
That is so fascinating. And it what I just got from what you described there, and it makes so much sense to me, is just as economies move in cycles, you know, you talked about when you have these different diagonals, and then you draw an event vertical line through them. So take a young generation that has a major event happen that tends to shape the rest of their lives. You know, we all know the stories of the people who grew up in the Depression, who in the later prosperity of the late part of the 20th century, they were still storing, you know, flour away in their attics, right?
Big balls of string, you know, exactly.
My point is you can kind of predict how they're going to act when they're running the show based upon the forces that applied to them in their young careers.
And that's what I try to do in the book. And what I try to do is not just say how that's an interesting way to look at history, but how can we actually apply that to the future? Yep. Let's look at each of today's generations and try to tell their future diagonal. Now, the person who invented this idea of diagonals, the generational diagonal, was actually a French social scientist back in the 1920s, Émile Littré. And he wrote a book called Les Générations Sociales. And he invented the term social generation, you know, which is what we're talking about, right? A cohort unit in time. But he said he likened the succession of generations to tiles on a roof. I mean, isn't that a wonderful metaphor? They're like, you know, they're those diagonals, right? I mean, you know, those are the tiles on a roof. And I think that's a fascinating way to look at history, right?
All right, Neil, that is this has been super fascinating, and I've done a terrible job of wrapping this up, as I promised I was going to do about 20, 25 minutes ago. But this has been really, really important. Thank you so much for giving us so much your time and for sharing how you, you know, see the framework that you use and then how you use that to project what may happen in the future. Just sort of in concluding, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. What I've taken away from, I'm taking away a lot from what you've said, but one of the key things I'm taking away for the individual from here is the importance of being in tighter real world relationships going into what's coming ahead here. And that's both on the selfish side of things, right? I want to make it through this as best I can. You know, you said earlier, hey, the financial side of things is going to get rocky. And, you know, you may end up on the losing side of that going forward. Probably a lot of people are going to end up on the losing side of that going forward. So it's going to be your individual community, your family coming together, supporting each other, that's going to get the majority of people through this. So you really should be looking into investing in your relationships with your family, with your children, with your neighbors, with your community, all that type of stuff, just from a pure selfishness, like I want to make it through this as best as possible. But then as we go into, you know, the new dawn that comes out of here in the next first turning, as you talked about, there's a lot of kind of, you know, there's a stronger communal bond that comes from that. There's almost sort of the brotherhood of the foxhole of going through all this pain together. But the success, that the prosperity that new cycle builds is built on the fact of this greater social cohesion of people coming together, working together for their greater good versus just my own individual destiny here, right? So it sounds like there is a calling here for us beyond just the selfish part of it, of sort of leaning into society again going forward. And, you know, we have such a disconnected society now, which is so ironic given that we have social media, which lets us talk to so many more people in the digital era. But in terms of like interacting in the real world with real people and putting my own interests secondary to what, you know, the group needs, it sounds like there's kind of almost going to be a calling in the future. You know, if we want to be a part of getting to the better, if we want to play a constructive role to getting to the better future, and if maybe we want to do our little part to try to accelerate our ability to get there a little bit faster, history is kind of calling on all of us to maybe kind of lean in to these real world relationships. Am I taking away something good from this that you'd like me to?
I think that's absolutely right. And I would say that, the generation that's going to be on the cutting edge of that, I think, will be the generation which is still moving into young adulthood, the millennials, right? I mean, they will be more into that perspective than older generations. I think they already are. You know, they value this idea of teamwork writ large, you know, the scaling up of things.
Sorry to interrupt, but I've got two Gen Z daughters. And I can sort of see from watching that generation, I think they're even more into that than the millennials. Well,
and a lot of these Gen Zers, I would actually define as the last wave millennials. So we kind of redate, you know, we redraw the lines on the generations a little bit, but there's no question that these late wave millennials who are now, you know, going into high school now, and, you know, about to graduate high school are kind of extreme versions of the trend with millennials, you know, toward greater sort of teamwork, protection, risk aversion, you know, all of those things, which gained force, you know, from the first wave millennials to the last wave millennials. But I think this generation will embody that more. And I think a lot of older generations might have, some of them, a little bit of trouble fitting in this new world, right? Much as the lost generation had trouble fitting in the 1950s. A group or a community was everything. And of course, they, you know, a lot of them, those that weren't totally burned out, you know, like the F. Scott Fitzgeralds and the Hemingways, but many of these people had a hard time fitting into this new sort of homogenous society of the 50s. And I think we may find a lot of boomers and Xers, you know, struggling a little bit more. I think it's going to be a world much more built for and by millennials. I mean, I hate to say this, still the generations, but that happens. You know, that's inevitable, right? Your point about community is also interesting. The person who I think everyone associates with writing about community is Robert Putnam. He wrote the famous book, Bowling Alone, probably the best known sociologist in America today, talking about how this is a generational trend, right? I mean, the generation that came out of World War II and was children during World War II and the Great Depression were a great community-oriented generation. They did everything in groups. I mean, when they went bowling with the Elks Club, right? And so they went bowling in groups. Well, we started getting boomers and even more with Xers. They're all free agents. They go bowling alone, you know, hence the title of his book, Bowling Alone. But he does admit about two-thirds of the shift is generational. That is to say, it's not that everyone started doing things more individually. It's that younger people started doing things more individually, and they just aged older. And the older people didn't change. They just aged out, right? I mean, that's how this happened. Well, now we see a new aging in of a more community-oriented generation. You see how this, and Robert Putnam has always said, this is not a one-way change. He doesn't think this is a one-way movement in history. He thinks this is a cyclical movement. I agree with him. And I think he dated it correctly. He said it was the GI and the silent generation, which were the community-oriented generation. He said the peak of community-oriented behavior in this country, and he measured all kinds of things. Adam, I mean, he measured, lawyers per capita. Do people actually come to a stop at a stop sign, you know, with when other people aren't looking? I mean, all of these different kinds of things. How often do you invite, you know, neighbors over to your home? Just going all of these things. And he said that the peak of community-oriented behavior was about 1964, just before the awakening broke out, right? Which I think was dating it correctly. And by the time American Graffiti came out, you know, and all the boomers are coming of age, you know, the tagline for the movie was, "Where were you in 62? And it was a great movie in American nostalgia, right? We all look back, what was America like before it all went, you know, before it all started dissolving? And it was a mixture of sort of wonder, nostalgia, and horror, because, you know, a lot of the boomers actually didn't like America in the American high, yet we were fascinated by it at the same time, right? And we admitted that we were part of the problem, right? I mean, we did dissolve America. And I think coming to terms with that is another aspect of, as we move into, you know, as the saeculum completes, right, we begin to retrace earlier eras of our history, so to speak, in terms of social moods, that we kind of think about that, don't we? And I would say among millennials, a lot of the things that we think about the American high don't seem so bad. Right? I know a lot of boomers hated it. A lot of Xers think, what a peculiar period. There was a famous movie called Pleasantville. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it was a bunch of Xers travel back to a black and white world in the American high. It was just full of, you know, bigotry and a sort of cultural blindness and Xers re-enliven everything, you know, bring back color to that world. by introducing people to bizarre new cultural ideas, and I think a lot of sex, as I recall. I mean, that was part of the formula.
I remember that from the movie, yeah.
But you think about how mischaracterized that era is in retrospect. I mean, it's interesting. Sex actually is one of the things that no one is enjoying anymore today. You know, think about the things we blamed about the American high. Well, I tell you, young people are a lot more enthusiastic about sex than young people are today. And you wonder who deserves to call whose era a wasteland. You know what I mean?
Right.
Is it our era or is it theirs? I mean, think about it. And I think even about racial progress in this country. I don't know, at the end of that era, we had the Civil Rights Act. What are we doing today? You understand where I'm going with this? There was a certain sense of progress that we were trying to build, and we had the confidence to attempt it. Today, we don't have that confidence.
Okay, and so what I hear you saying, I think, and don't let me put these words in your mouth, but you're kind of corroborating my point, which is a success strategy not just for us as individuals, but for us as a society, is to lean back in to how can I play a role or being more connected with my fellow man and working towards a greater good than just what's going to be best for me.
Exactly.
All right. Well, look, Neil, I could go on for another 2 hours, and I'm sure there are folks who are going to chime in the comments if they wish we did. But if you don't mind, I will take you up on your kind offer there to have you back on again at some point. We can really roll up our sleeves and dive into the coming first turning that hopefully will make up for all the lumps we're about to take over the next 6 or 7 years ahead of us here. As we wrap up, Neil, where is the best place for people to go buy this book? Is it just the Amazons of the world?
Anywhere. I mean, you can go Barnes and Noble, Amazon, any of the chains. I mean, it's virtually available everywhere.
I guess a New York Times bestseller is pretty much sold anywhere they sell books.
It's pretty much everywhere. Yeah, you won't have much time, much problem finding it. For those who like audibles or audiobooks, just to remind people, I actually do the audio of this. So I actually did the whole thing. Yeah, I spent a week and a half in a studio. And it's actually quite popular, the audio version. If people want to follow our work or anything that we do, we're actually starting on Substack during August. So to follow up on us, you can go to fourthturning.com and just follow the links from there. So.
Okay, great. That was my last question, was where should folks go to follow you and your work? So Neil, we will put up the URL to your Substack when we edit this video. My friend, this has been just a phenomenal conversation. Thank you for giving us so much of your time. Congratulations on the success of this book. And Neil, really look forward to having you back on this program again soon.
Great, will do. Thanks, Adam.
All right. Well, now's the time in the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Wealthion, both to do a little bit of reaction to the key takeaways from this discussion with Neil, as well as talk about what the markets have been up to over the past week. And actually, on the day we're recording here, there's some interesting stuff going on. I'm joined today by John Lodra, other lead partner from New Harbor. Mike Preston has the week off. John, great to see you.
Hello, Adam. Great to be back with you again. And a fascinating conversation with Neil Howe. Really a leading mind on demographics and absolutely, these things that he talks about have a big picture influence on the things that affect our lives and certainly the financial markets over time, anyways, that we are here to navigate with our clients. So really enjoyed his conversation. Man, there's just so many takeaways. I almost can't encapsulate it. And in fact, I confessed to last night listening to, I subscribe to a service called Blinkist. It's basically a idiot's guide to shortening great books. And it's basically a service where you can listen to just a summary of a book for busy people like me. And I listened to basically a 10-minute Blink summary of his first book to remind myself of the key points in that book of his first book and certainly relevant leading into what his current book is in the fourth turning, the fourth stage of the cycle. So really enjoyed kind of a reminder. It's scary when you think about the implications, but look, these times and these situations call for realism, kind of awakening, to use one of his terms, even though we're well beyond the awakening stage. And I would agree with him that we're in the fourth turning, before a cleansing that leads to the stage that he calls the high again. And I think we're seeing evidence of that in so many elements of our social life, our institutions, our level of divide politically and otherwise, and even in the daily behaviors, the apathy, the ability, inability for younger people to afford a home, the massive concentration of power in a few large companies, and these things all go through cycles. We can harken back to the day of the robber barons. There's a pendulum here where I think we'll likely see a backlash and some of these large behemoth tech companies that have been the major powerhouse of stock market returns this year. I think we're going to see a pendulum societally and institutionally to to start to break those apart or diminish their power, and just so many things to pull out of that. I'm really looking forward to talking about that with you, Adam.
Great. Neil, it's interesting. This is a little bit different stock than we talk about with you guys, because there's you're talking about sort of the arc of history here and just sort of grandiose societal changes. But of course, at the end of the day, concerned listener says, okay, great. Well, if all that's going to happen, like, what do I need to do? And how do I not just get crushed, by all these changes? And, Neil did say that, look, in at the end of a fourth turning, the status quo breaks down. That's what gets replaced when the cyclone starts again. And the financial markets are no exception. That's not going to get spared, he doesn't think, this time around, right? So, we can talk about some of the main themes that he mentioned there, but I do want to try to make this sort of practically useful for folks that just listened to the interview with him and said, okay, gosh, well, what should I be doing here? And, from my notes here, I just sort of starred like, hey, you got to become resilient, both financially resilient, like you got to make sure you've structured a portfolio here that can weather a lot of different slings and arrows. But you also just need to become resilient in your lifestyle. I think the number one investment he said was like, get to know your neighbors and pull your family members around you and have discussions about how are we going to support each other through what's coming here? Because past historical cycles, a lot of people lost a lot, maybe even everything. And all they really had was their social community to help them get through it all, right? But he talked about the importance of diversification and true diversification, across asset classes, paper assets, real assets, basically underscored that, hey, things are going to become a lot more important, both at the national level, right, as there's going to be more and more competition versus cooperation around increasingly scarce resources. But also just that's what folks are going to really care about, real assets, commodities, things that can't have their value either defaulted on or inflated away, right? And I know that's been a lens that you guys at New Harbor have looked through for a long time, is the importance of the real world. That's why you guys have been sort of big fans of hard assets and commodities and the companies that produce them, mine them, refine them, et cetera. I know that's somewhat reflected already in your allocations there. I just kind of took from the overarching message that he was giving is, hey, we got to prepare for kind of a decline in all sorts of things, living standards, quality of governance, but also, the price of financial assets. They're likely going to be one of the casualties of what's going on here. Now, of course, nobody has a crystal ball. We don't know exactly how it's all going to unfold. I didn't get a sense from Neil that he said, hey, sell every paper asset you have tomorrow. But basically what it's saying is, or what I took away from that is just, okay, with these grandiose turnings or gear turns of the fourth turning, what should we as investors be doing with our wealth to say, okay, I want to make sure, I make it through this out okay. So anyways, I'm going to hand the football back to you. I know that's a grandiose, it's a big question to have to answer as a portfolio manager. And again, I want to underscore here, and I'll let you do the same. This is not a message to just sell every paper asset you have tomorrow. It's just to be mindful of the risks going forward.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, Adam. The kinds of turnings and cycles that Neil talks about are, to our observation, very slow moving. When you're living in the moment, you don't really see them happening in the same clarity that hindsight certainly can provide. But nonetheless, they are happening in small and measurable and impactful ways. Our day-to-day job of managing investments, obviously, we want to be very cognizant of the bigger picture trends and cycles underway, but also understand that these things take time to really embed in terms of behaviors and markets, behaviors and consumers and governments and institutions. So, but the important thing is to have the construct to allow for, some of these things that he's talked about. So, for example, we have been big proponents of commodities and including precious metals. And we've gone very clearly out to say that we think that most folks should have precious metals you know, we kind of think of them as having split personalities, both an investment vehicle, and primarily we express that in our client portfolios right now by owning we think a proper size, about a 10% model allocation to gold mining stocks, which fundamentally are very undervalued. If you forget what they do for them, just on their financial profile, is very undervalued, and we think can see significant upside even without the price of metal going much higher, which we do think it will. We also think that tangible physical precious metals represents an insurance policy that you can almost think about not as an investment, just like you think about insurance on your house, your health, your car, whatever. And what is that insurance? It's about some of the stuff that it's insurance against some of the stuff that that Neil talks about in the fourth turning that certainly have ramifications from an investment standpoint. We're hearing, you know, we're seeing right before our eyes, folks starting to not trust the system. The whole cryptocurrency emergence is an expression of a widening body of the populace saying, hey, you know, we want to take control of this thing we call money, and not have it be a point of control by governments and institutions that have gone way, way too far. And that speaks to the whole, you know, transition from centralized institutions to increasing individualism that Neil talked about. So in a proper investment portfolio, we think it's very proper to think about having things in there like precious metals, physical precious metals, that you don't think about as an investment as much as an insurance policy against some of these, emerging real big concerns that will likely play out. And like with any insurance policy, you can't guarantee that you'll need it. You hope you don't need it. And just like if you have life insurance, you hope you don't die right away. Same here. No one wants to have that insurance policy really be needed, but it's really important. But that's from an investment standpoint. So markets go through cycles. You look at the interest rate cycle, for example. We last 40 years or so, we've been in a basically declining interest rate cycle. It would be utterly naive to think that we're going to see a cycle that lasts like that same way going forward. We're probably going to see and that gets to Neil's comment about, you know, bonds tend to do very poorly during this fourth turning kind of phase because of inflation and shakiness and erosion of the sanctity of institutions. It just so happens that we're on the heels of, within the last several hours, of Fitch issuing a credit downgrade to the U.S. Treasury bonds, U.S. credit. I think it's kind of a little bit of a smoke and mirrors kind of token thing, but it speaks to the bigger picture. We think physical assets, most financial assets, we think are likely to reprice lower. And if no other reason, just some of the inequalities, both from, corporate profits at the expense of employee wages, high wealth versus low wealth, some of those things, during fourth turn, it's really come into more of a closing of the gap. And that absolutely, we think, will have ramifications on things like asset prices. Again, these are big cycles that I don't want to like project. This is a go out and sell everything today, but just be mindful of and have a mindset like most folks should. Think about your retirement period. If you're 65 and retiring, you should be thinking about 30 plus years. That's absolutely the kind of time frame that these kinds of things can play out. And not having a plan to adapt and be cognizant of those things, we think is very short-sighted. And I'll just finish with the point you reinforced as well as Neil. We all the time tell our clients, look, there's only so much we can do. We look after a financial piece of your equation, but in these uncertain times, more important than, just as important, if not more so than having financial means, is having the emotional resilience to and community. So, no one wants to be sitting on a pile of money when everybody around them is in literal depression because of the world around them. It's having that sense of community. That's where real wealth and enrichment comes from. And it's great to have the means and the financial foundation, but without that emotional resilience, I think folks will be setting themselves up for an unhappy life, unfulfilled.
Not to stoke fears unnecessarily, but if if you're the guy in your neighborhood with a lot of money and everybody else is destitute and everybody knows you're the guy with money, you may not be able to hold on to that money for much longer if everybody just is desperate enough to come after you for it. But well said, you know, a couple of things, again, I just want to underscore here. You know, one, nobody has a crystal ball, right? So things may take, they may take a different trajectory than Neil expects. I mean, he's much, much smarter on the arc of history than I am. So I give a lot of weight to his forecast here. He also talked about how the turnings are taking longer to and longer to play out here. And by that stretch, he's now thinking, you know, 2030, early 2030s for when the end of the turning is. And these things tend to kind of, you know, asymptotically collapse, right? They kind of just grind downwards slowly, and then there's sort of a waterfall cascade at the end. So the point being is it could be another decade before the chickens really come home to roost on this. I mean, it seems like it's going to be a downward trajectory, but the worst of this, you know, is not necessarily on our doorstep tomorrow, right? So again, I don't want to give people I don't want to stoke a fear that says, oh my gosh, I've got to change my life radically tomorrow for this, right? And especially when it comes to your money, you shouldn't be making decisions based from emotion. You shouldn't be making them certainly based from the emotion of fear. That usually leads to really bad decision-making. You should just be engaged and thoughtful and work with professionals to come up with a plan, have hedges in place, have what-if scenarios in place. But I really want to underscore here, you know, what we're not telling everybody is, you know, sell everything and get in the bunker tomorrow.
Yeah. I think, Adam, it's also very important to emphasize that I think that very well can be likely be the case. You know, let's call it this thing kind of resolves, or we enter kind of the high in what he calls the high, the period of rebirth, the spring season, if you will, in the 2030s, early 2030s. That very likely could be the time frame we're looking at. But I think it's naive to think that financial markets continue on some extrapolation of, for example, this year to date until then. In fact, if you go back, just look at like the late 60s to the early 80s, I think that might be an instructive period. Basically, the stock market went nowhere, lost money on an inflation-adjusted basis. There were several big rallies followed by big declines, where people got annihilated, either financially or emotionally. It was a very, very tough time for markets, and very few types of investments did well. And it required a very tactical approach. And you know, we think that's probably the environment that we'll likely see, even as we're working through this resolution towards, again, to use Neil's, you know, spring season or awakening phase. You know, the markets are primed to be very challenged as we work through out these changes.
Yeah, and as we have had many talks on this channel, you know, we could talk about how returns over the next decade are likely to be negative. And that's just largely based on where valuations are today. And, you know, folks like John Hussman do great analysis that show us that. So we can tell that story of caution already in the markets going forward from here, irrespective of how's work. And then when we take Neil's work into account, it's like, oh my gosh, then we have this whole other set of reasons, you know, to be cautious going forward, right? So totally agree with you saying. I just wanted to underscore, which I think you more or less just did there too, which is, you know, we could still have some years of real positive market growth ahead of us here, right? So again, you don't want to take all your chips off the table and hunker down in the bunker necessarily today for something that might happen 10 years from now, right? You want to be cognizant of it. You want to have a plan in place for it, but you don't want to make extreme decisions today at time zero. I want to mention something else you talked about too, two other things. One is you mentioned the recent Fitch downgrade, which is still being, you know, aggressively parsed right now in the media, whether it was merited, why it was done, all that type of stuff. What I do find interesting about it is the last time that Fitch downgraded the US's credit rating was, I think you looked this up before we turned the cameras on here, John, I think it might have been August of 2011. Is that when it was?
Yeah, that's correct. Yep. Well, that was actually S&P downgrade. So the, you know, two main rating services, S&P and Fitch. S&P downgraded the US debt credit rating in August of 2011. Yeah.
August of 2011. And I remember when that happened, everybody was sort of like, hey, thanks a lot, S&P. Like, we just went through the global financial crisis a couple of years before, and now you're downgrading the economy. Like, this would have been a lot more helpful if you had done this like maybe 3 or 4 years prior, right? It's kind of almost like your house burning down. You're staring at the smoldering ruins, and then all of a sudden your fire alarm starts going off, right?
Yeah, there was a certain sentiment that it was sour grapes because S&P got, I forget if they got fined or slapped on the wrist or whatever, but basically pointed as, you know, a sleep at the wheel by the regulators and the authorities leading into the housing crisis. So that may have been, you know, a bit of sour grapes here. Well, now we'll show it to you. Right?
Yeah. We'll get our kick in by downgrading it. But what's interesting is, so that was done so after the fact, right? What's interesting is right now, so we're being told, you know, we have a strong economy, jobs are good, economic growth is 2 to 3%, and you know, Bidenomics is working, and you know, markets back on track, S&P is getting close to all-time highs, right? So it is interesting that this warning is coming out in an environment that's much more, you know, it's being sold as much, you know, stronger, robust. We're not in tough times. 2022 was a rough year, but it was no great global financial crisis, right? So it does seem kind of interesting that this is happening when, metaphorically at least, the sun appears to be shining in the U.S. economy. So, you know, maybe this is the rating agencies maybe being a little more proactive in doing their job and looking at a lot of the macro data that we've been talking about that has been, you know, pretty ugly, and some of it's still getting worse. I don't know. We'll see. Again, like I said, it's sort of being hotly debated in real time right now. But it's notable to me that it doesn't seem like it was last time, where it was clearly way too late in the game to be any use to anybody. Maybe this is a sign that sentiment is souring earlier this time.
Yeah, and I think it's, well, we know this from hindsight. I'm not trying to be a party pooper here, but when things are rosy, that's super rosy or believed to be, that's usually, you know, we're closer to a top and late in the ball game than early stages of a new rebirth and growth in the market. Just by way of data, if you look at, for example, where the Shiller PE valuation metric is today, it's in the low 30s ish, 31 or something like that. It was closer to about 20, I think, in 2011. So just on a valuation metric level, the market was about a third, 33%, 30+% more overvalued now than then. And that's, I can point all kinds of flaws or adjustments you could do to margins and things like that, that would even suggest we're even that much more extreme now. The reason I raise this is because you're going to see headlines out there saying, well, the last time, you know, the U.S. credit rating got downgraded, stocks were up, you know, X percent a year later, bonds were up, you know, Y percent a year later, and as if the starting valuation has no matter. And I think that's fundamentally flawed. I think we're in a totally. So be careful of those easy layup kind of headlines that say, hey, last time this happened, you know, stocks were up this. So, hey, it's going to happen again. Right. That's just very simplistic and doesn't mean it can't happen. But it just ignores a lot of real important context.
Okay. And you were talking earlier, too, sort of about the value of insurance. And just a personal anecdote, my wife actually got in a car accident yesterday on the way to work, totally during her routine, you know, the drive that she's made a zillion times before. And again, just underscores the importance of having insurance, right? You know, by definition, nobody really ever expects an accident, right? They occur from out of the blue, right? And so, you know, we just got a reminder yesterday of the value of having insurance, right? Unfortunately, she's okay and looks like the car is going to be fixable and all that stuff. But, you know, it was, like I said, it was just a great reminder from the universe that, yeah, having good insurance in advance is super, super valuable. All right. So the day we're talking here, John, the markets are actually having a pretty bumpy ride. And we've been kind of gotten conditioned over the past couple of months to, you know, sort of felt like the good old days for a lot of investors, where the markets just kind of kept going up and up and up, where they take a little breather, but just sort of, you know, hang out at an unchanged level before things pick back up. Today is the first day in a while that we've seen, you know, drops of 1-2% or so in the major indices. Way too early to call anything in terms of a reversal or whatnot, but we've been, both you guys and our other endorsed partner, Lance Roberts and his firm at Real Investment Advisors, you know, have been basically kind of cautioning, look, the markets have powered so strongly for so long now that even just a relief retracement of, you know, anywhere, I think from 3-10% or so, like, would definitely be merited at this point in time. Could we be beginning to see the start of that here?
Oh, we absolutely could be. You know, just to put some numbers behind what we just talked about there, Adam, about the probabilities or likelihood of a near-term pullback. And I was just looking at the options market last week, just to kind of assess the market implied pricing as to the upside versus downside risk. And one way you can do that is by comparing the premiums of that you can get by selling call options to the premiums you need to pay for downside insurance and put options. A hedge, if you will, selling a call option, buying a put option on an underlying investment vehicle, like an S&P 500 fund or something like that. And, you know, just arbitrarily, you can pick the different legs to determine how much upside you can allow yourself and what kind of downside you would have to absorb to make it a so-called costless caller to make those hedges, the legs of the options offset each other from a revenue and cost standpoint. And just for example, last week, it was, you know, the numbers panned out to get like about 5% upside. This is over a month. It was like a month outdated option. To get about 5% upside, you would have to be willing to bear about 11% downside. And that was just how the options market was pricing it. So that's roughly about a 2-to-1 downside to upside. And that doesn't mean the 5% upside couldn't happen. It just means the market is implying a probability of 2 units of downside risk potential to every 1 unit of upside. That's probably changed as of today. We've had some pretty dramatic moves here. But yeah, we could, I mean, we're still at nosebleed valuation levels, still a market that is has been carried this year higher by a small, you know, cadre of stocks. Is definitely expanded and broadened out. Some sectors have followed through very, very convincingly, but we're still broadly overvalued. And we're in an environment where interest rates are becoming a real thing. You know, just the big news over the last week is what's happened to interest rates, longer term interest rates, not just the short term. You know, the Fed recently, you know, did their July hike like everybody knew they would. But what the real newsworthy thing is the move higher in yields on, say, 10 and 30-year Treasury bonds. Very sharp spike. In fact, today we took out on the 10-year and the 30-year, I believe, the recent highs in yields back in early July. And, of course, that has caused bonds to sell off pretty good. Now, what's causing that could be any number of things. And, this is even before the Fitch downgrade. Last week, the first shot over the bow was the Japanese Central Bank talking about, you know, came out with a kind of a out of left field announcement that, hey, that we're going to revisit our yield curve control policy, their mechanism for controlling interest rates in Japan. And that sent a little bit of a shockwave through credit markets. It wasn't as big as it initially was feared to be. But then the other big thing is the Treasury announced that they're going to issue, I think, $1 trillion of new debt this quarter, up of I think a full $250 billion higher than what was estimated not too long ago. So the market is basically saying, "Whoa, geez, way more debt issuance by the Treasury," and I think the market is reading into that. You know, unlike how they filled the TGA account when the debt ceiling was resolved, they did it mostly through a short-term Treasury bill issuance, you know, some short-term financing. I think the market's kind of perceiving that they're going to extend the maturity there and tap more the notes and bonds market, which I think is caused the run up in yields here. And then of course the Fitch rating, as kind of superficial as it might be, or you know, kind of ornamental or whatever you want to call it, it certainly maybe has contributed to the sell off in yields today. But that's been the big thing. And cost of capital. You know, we've talked about it several times, Adam, with you and your guests. You know, as this cost of capital starts, the cost of refinancing, things like that, starts to ripple through the economy, whether it's corporate debt refinancings, commercial real estate resets, things, loan resets, this is going to have a big impact. And it, you know, it certainly doesn't bode well for higher asset prices. It bodes for lower asset prices.
Well, you know, I've joked, John, that I'm going to change my last name to Laggart, just to really continue to try to build awareness for the potential impact of the lag effect, because I think it is being widely ignored by much of the market and much of society right now. But sadly, and this is me showing my own cards here, folks, you know, I believe the vast majority of the impact of that still lies ahead of us, right? So time will tell, but we'll see. All right, John, I hate to do this, but we got to start wrapping up here just because the Neil interview was so long. Tacking this on, I don't want to make it so long that people are fearful of actually watching the video because it's hours long in length. In wrapping up, I do want to make a quick nod to something on the positive side of things. I just recorded an interview this morning with Justin Hune. He's the publisher of Uranium Insider. We did kind of a market update on what's going on in the nuclear energy space right now. A lot of really interesting stuff going on there in terms of policy changes. But basically, the momentum for nuclear is really continuing to build, and you know, potentially to invest in the uranium space and in uranium miners and companies in that sector. There seems to be a really bright future ahead. But folks, if that's of any interest to you, go watch that video. It's on the channel here. One thing I didn't get a chance to ask Justin, because that interview ran long as well, but I just want to note it here in case it becomes proven out going forward. The morning we're recording this, there was breaking news of a room temperature superconductor, which, if indeed one has been achieved that can be made commercially viable, would be a massive game changer for humanity. I mean, really for how we conduct the economy, how our energy systems work. It would be a tremendous boom to us. One of the articles I read this morning, you know, said easily on par with the development of the transistor in terms of its importance. I'm taking all this with a really big boulder of salt right now, because I remember, John, being in high school and writing a paper on the Pons-Fleischmann, I believe it was, discovery, which back then was, quote unquote, a room temperature superconductor that then turned out not to be replicable by other scientists and turned out to basically just be, you know, a massive flash in the pan. Hopefully this time it might be different, but who knows? But I wanted to put that on here just in case it turns out that it actually is the real deal. I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about it a lot on this channel going forward. And definitely, depending upon the timeline of commercialization, it could have a real boom effect on a lot of factors, and maybe even push out, you know, or disrupt the turning timeline that that Neil mentioned potentially. So we'll see. But in wrapping up here, folks, if this phenomenal conversation with Neil Howe about his new book and all those key trends of the turnings and the what lies ahead potentially in this last fourth turning that we're currently in, if that kind of blew your mind in terms of the risk exposure that presents, and you really do want to get yourself to a position where you feel like your investments are taking those potential risks into account, highly, highly recommend, as I do every week on this channel, that you seek the guidance and counsel of a good professional financial advisor, but especially one that takes into account what Neil talked about in this conversation. And I'll be really honest, folks, I would say the vast majority of financial advisors out there probably never even heard of Neil Howe or the fourth turning. Like, it's not even on their radars. It's certainly not something that's impacting their investment philosophy or their portfolio construction. So make sure you find a financial advisor that does take all that into account and sit down with them and have the conversation about, hey, you know, what should I be doing in light of this? If you've got a good one who can do that for you, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even John and his team there at New Harbor Financial, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. To do that, just fill out the short form at Wealthion.com. www.ncbi.com. Only takes you a couple seconds to do so. These consultations are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a public service that they offer to help people position as prudently as possible in advance of potentially the shoes that may drop that Neil warned us all about here. John, as we wrap up here, you know, as I like to say, you know, every week you guys at New Harbor are talking to people every day, multiple times a day, helping them with their real world financial goals, as well as helping them deal with their real world financial challenges. Any parting bits of advice based upon the key themes that people are contacting you about these days?
Well, we every day we have a multitude of things we talk to clients about that goes well beyond kind of markets and their investments. Every week we seem to have conversations with folks about how and when to take Social Security, the different trade-offs of early versus later, folks thinking about real estate moves and the financial implications of this and that. You know, all to say is that, you know, our job here, it is brought right back to the people we work with and their lives. It's not just about, you know, a digitized account on the screen that has numbers that move around, hopefully more up than down. It's really about people and you know, hopefully empowering them to have the security to live a comfortable life and you know, have as little stress in their life as possible. And that gets to the emotional kind of awakening that we all need to go through on a daily basis, irrespective of bigger picture trends. I just wanted to quickly add to your thing on the nuclear, Adam. This week, it was newsworthy that the first nuclear power plant in the U.S. was, in many, many years, was started up in Georgia, the Vogtle nuclear power unit. And that was a really interesting, I think it's a timely thing to dovetail into your conversation. I spent the first decade of my career in the energy industry, so I'm kind of geeked out about this kind of stuff. So I'm really, really excited to see these developments and how they play out.
Thanks. Good note. That was one of the many reasons why I had Justin on the channel this week, because there is a lot of news, that being one example that's hitting the wires right now. Yeah, that was the first reactor to go online commercially in almost 7 years in the U.S., which also points to the fact that, you know, we're so far behind the game in advancing nuclear right now. And again, folks, I understand all the questions, concerns that many people still have about nuclear. Way too little time to address them here at the end of this video. But if you want to really dig into those topics, look at some of the past videos that I've done recorded with Justin Hune on this exact topic. All right. Well, look, folks, if you enjoyed having Neil Howe on this program, would like to see him come back on the channel soon, like he offered to do, please vote your support for that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. John, thanks so much again for yet another great week. Everyone else, thanks so much for watching.